Welcome to the 2011 edition of Hanukkah Lights, readings for the holiday season with Susan Stamberg and Murray Horwitz. On this year's show, four stories written especially for Hanukkah Lights. We'll hear Nona Maccabeus by Gloria Davidis Kirchheimer, Ethics of the Fathers by Tamar Yellen, First Day by Elisa Albert, and Fidelis by Erica Dreyfus. All on Hanukkah Lights for 2011 from NPR.
Nona Maccabeus by Gloria Davidis Kirchheimer. Someone had the bright idea that the residents of the Coney Island Sephardic home would enjoy some entertainment on the first night of Hanukkah. The social director was ecstatic. She wore her wig as though it were a crown of office. My grandmother laughed at her behind her back. No sabe nada, she doesn't know anything, she said to me when I came for my weekly visit. But Nona, I said, she went to school. She knows all about working in a place like this. Mrs. Steinberg's PhD meant nothing to my grandmother. Nona, who was never taught to read as a girl in Izmir, Turkey, was proud of my grandfather, a lay rabbi, because he knew how to read. And so do I, Nona. She took her hand and put it on my stomach. Reading can make a woman crazy, she said. All you need to read are the signs and wonders. They will tell you to be fruitful and multiply. Your grandfather was the light of my eyes, la luz de mis ojos. We were speaking in Ladino, the medieval Spanish we carried with us from Spain after the Inquisition and into the Ottoman Empire. Nona had taught me many proverbs and songs. She was humming one now as she rocked on the veranda. The Coney Island Sephardic home faced the boardwalk and the parachute jump. It was a warm day for December, and the smell of cotton candy wafted over us. But most importantly, one could smell the sea breezes, which were known to have curative powers. I held Nona's hand as she urged me to breathe. Our respirations were interrupted by the arrival of Mrs. Steinberg, or Doctor, as she preferred to be called. She smiled at me and said to Nona, "Ashena Madel." Dr. Steinberg had not yet caught on to the fact that the majority of the residents of the home were Sephardic and not Ashkenazi like her, and could not understand Yiddish. Spanish, yes. Greek, Arabic, Turkish, French, Armenian, certainly. Nona wagged her finger at the woman and quoted a proverb in Ladino to the effect that a closed mouth will keep out flies. "Thanks, sweetie," the social director said to my 90-year-old grandmother. "You be good now." "They call her doctor," Nona said scornfully. "Where is her white jacket?" I knew that my grandmother had no faith in doctors, white jackets notwithstanding, and relied on a string of garlic tied around her waist to ward off the evil eye. I suspected from the telltale ridge around her middle that she was even now wearing such a belt. How she managed to procure enough garlic for the purpose was a mystery. She did hint that she was on excellent terms with the Hispanic kitchen workers, who would have had no difficulty understanding her. To them, she complained incessantly about the food. How she longed for some borrecas, fritadas, bizcochos, good Sephardic home cooking. She blessed me when I finally learned how to make some of these dishes and brought her samples to taste. Seeing Nona slipping into a doze, I caught up with the social director. "I heard," I said, "that there will be some entertainment next week for Hanukkah." Dr. Steinberg clasped her hands in devotion. The granddaughter of the president of the board of directors had offered to bring her little group of musicians to perform. They would do so at no charge. I asked if she had met them, or perhaps heard a tape. Steinberg's hand flew to her mouth in horror. "Oh, I couldn't do that," she said. "It would be an insult to Mr. Bensignor, the head of the board." I understood her position. The home was dependent on rich donors, and he was number one. "But why have entertainment at all?" I asked. "Everyone likes a Hanukkah party," she said defensively. "When I was a child, we had what we called a Hanukkah bush, and the kids got a present for each of the 8 days." For a moment, I was retroactively envious. As a Sephardic little girl, I had to be content with only one present for the holiday. "Also," Dr. Steinberg continued, "we can't have a repeat of what happened last year." The previous social director had presided over last year's Hanukkah and was fired immediately afterward. What happened was this. On the first night, each resident brought a menorah to the lounge. These were set on a long table, and one by one, they were lit by their owners. Just as the last candle was lit, one resident, Mr. Matalan, seized his menorah, a handsome, weighty silver object that had been in his family for generations, and refused to leave it with the others. Following the letter of the law, he was going to take it to his room and set it in a window so it could be seen by passers-by. "We have those mesh curtains in every room. You can't imagine," said Dr. Steinberg. A wrestling match ensued, during which two attendants were summoned to pry the elderly man's hands from his heirloom. In the course of the struggle, the menorah fell down and ignited the corner of a tablecloth. "Thank goodness it was only the first night," Dr. Steinberg said. "One candle plus the shamas. I was called in to interview for the social director's job the next day." I could see why she would want to erase the memory of last year's event with some entertainment. When I arrived at the home a week later, along with other relatives, for the first night of Hanukkah, there didn't seem to be any evidence of an incipient conflagration. Mr. Matalan, last year's firebrand, had rejoined his ancestors. People were already beginning to step up to the large table where all the candelabra had been set, each with a name tag to avoid controversy. Every resident was invited to light a candle on his or her own menorah with the assistance of an aide or a relative. Nona's hand was surprisingly steady, and she brushed me away when I offered to help. Dr. Steinberg kept glancing at the door to the lounge. Where were the entertainers? Was she going to have to come up with an alternative to what had been scheduled? "When do we eat?" the aristocratic Mr. Abravanel said, banging on the ground with his cane. Great tufts of hair sprouted from his ears, which at this point in his life were purely ornamental, since he was stone deaf and refused to wear a hearing aid. "Quick," Nona whispered to me, "give me the lokmas you brought me before he steals them." She started to pat me down, looking for this culinary treat, the Sephardic equivalent of latkes. Fortunately, at that moment, the door burst open, and a troop of young people came hurrying in, laughing. The musicians, at last. And here is what the elderly residents saw. A couple of young women with bare midriffs, despite the December weather. One of them sporting a twinkling belly button and tattoos up her arms, the other wearing a nose ring. Then there was a boy with one earring and a shaved head, wearing tight black leather. Another had dreadlocks, while the remaining boys, or maybe they were girls, were wearing scruffy sneakers and T-shirts. One of them had a large black hat on, the kind worn by some Hasidim. They carried a motley range of instruments. With an agonized smile, Dr. Steinberg introduced the leader, Dawn Bensignor, who began by saying, "Like, this is so not us, being late and all, but the van." She trailed off. The audience was getting restless. There was a lot of murmuring. A woman called out in Ladino, "Que vergüenza! Shame on you." "Okay, guys," Dawn said, "here's our hip-hop Hanukkah." Sound blasted out of the electric guitar while a bongo kept the beat. There was actually an oud, an ancient Middle Eastern instrument, making noises never anticipated by the shepherds of Anatolia. The music seemed to be a cross between Israeli rock and Times Square subway music, particularly the kind you hear when you switch from the number one train to the BMT. I half expected the writhing of one of the musicians to turn into a breakdance. The audience applauded politely at the end of each number, but some of the women were tittering. I noticed that my grandmother had disappeared, but her cane was under her chair, which meant she intended to return. "Now what about a sing-along?" Miss Bensignor suggested. Just then my grandmother appeared in the doorway, resplendent in a white silk outfit shot with gold and silver filigree. There were tassels at her wrists and at the hem of the garment. A fringe of gold coins hung from a silk cap over her forehead. In her hand, she held a tambourine. She raised it high and gave it a shake. The band whooped with delight. Everyone started clapping and shouting as though awakened from a stupor. In a quavering voice, Nona began singing a Hanukkah song in Ladino that I remembered from my childhood, and this time everyone joined in. Later, while helping Nona out of her costume, which must have been over 100 years old, I congratulated her on her performance. "I did it for your grandfather of blessed memory. He was the light of my eyes," she said again to me. "The light of the candles reminds me of him." She folded up the silk costume carefully, the vest, the balloon pants, the sash, the open caftan with its exquisite embroidery. "Now it's yours," she said. "But Nona," I said, "maybe next year." She shook her head. I kissed her and promised to come back soon. Though she didn't realize it, my grandmother had penetrated the significance of Hanukkah. Aside from the consecrated oil, the candles that burned for 8 days, Hanukkah was the victory of the Jews against their Hellenistic Syrian oppressors. In her own way, Nona was the spiritual descendant of the Maccabees who didn't give in to an alien culture. She was not going to be taken over, not by the Ashkenazim who controlled her daily activities, nor by the current youth culture. I think of her victory every time I light the candles.
Ethics of the Fathers by Tamar Yellen. It was the first night of Hanukkah and the first snowfall of the year across the north of England. By 4 o'clock, it was already dark. The big electric menorah over the entrance to the Berlinski Hebrew School threw a cheerful amber light onto the snow as the children arrived for the last class of the term. Tonight, there were to be games, songs, and prizes for the best students, and every child was to go home with a bag of Hanukkah treats, a tin menorah, a packet of sweets, and a box of nuts and raisins. That was the night Mr. Bialik failed to arrive to teach the third class, 12 and 13-year-olds. The children of the third class waited, in a manner of speaking. They snapped on the lights, they closed the classroom door, they took possession. Against the large windows, a clear reflection of their own bright dancing selves was thrown. Beyond it lay the muffled darkness of the deepening snow. After 10 minutes of initial caution, Daniel Rifkin swept the blackboard and began chalking up rude words in large, fragile letters. The girls drew artistic tributes to their latest heartthrobs. Someone started a paper fight, and Gary Cantor and David Greenblatt dashed off to do unspeakable things in the boys' cloakroom. Anthony kept his place. With his gateway to the Mishnah open before him and his pencils at the ready, he sat more quietly even than usual, as though stilled by the surrounding uproar. But beneath the desk, his fingers trembled with suppressed excitement, for calamity was in the air. Something terrible was about to happen. A boy would fall from the desk on which he was climbing and break his neck, the door would open and a death would be announced. As the minute hand touched 15 past, Anthony reached into his school bag and brought out his math homework. He wrote the date and underlined it, but he could not concentrate on the algebra problem. His eye wandered to the scuffed and torn first page of his Gateway to the Mishnah with its ornamented titles. A ball of paper skimmed across his desk. He ignored it. He placed his shaking hands on his knees and waited. Not so much for his own sake as for the sake of their consciences, his parents had enrolled Anthony in religious classes at the age of 9. There, as if to establish the gulf between his sacred and secular selves, he was given the Hebrew name Elchanan, meaning God is grace. The entrance hall of the Berlinski School had a large blue Star of David in its patterned floor and smelt of cleaning fluid from the neighboring bathrooms. Anthony attended every evening, Monday to Thursday, and on Sunday mornings from 10 o'clock till 12. For the first 2 years, he came under the strict but kindly tutelage of Mrs. Berg, who opened the mysteries of the alphabet, told stories, and was liberal with her Sunday prizes. From Mrs. Berg's, he was promoted to the third class, with its dark desks and triple blackboard covered in declensions of the verb to kill, which, being entirely regular, was a favorite paradigm. Here the students recited, from battered Pentateuchs, The Miracle at the Red Sea, The Dream of the Seven Fat Cows and the Seven Thin Ones, and The Death of Moses, all in the same soft monotone and beneath Mr. Bialik's watchful stare. He was a tall, stooping man with the face of an aged frog, a black coat, and the faded silk skullcap of the truly religious. His horn-rimmed glasses, which hung dangerously at the edge of his desk most of the time, could be swept onto his nose at a moment's notice. His teaching methods were simple and severe. He believed in the virtues of copying, reciting, and learning by heart. To be taught by Mr. Bialik was to discover a true terror of ignorance. Bar mitzvah boys who were put through their paces by him emerged with a new maturity, no longer boys, but young men. This was his sanctum sanctorum, the dim room with its 15 students stationed irregularly, like the audience at an unpopular play, the Hebrew Pentateuch with its bristling text, the curious, dislocated chant of the children, Hebrew and English, Hebrew and English. They studied Genesis, Exodus, and Deuteronomy, avoided the legal passages, and progressed only to Judges and Kings. The prophets were beyond them. Gideon wrung the dew from his fleece, Samson died with the Philistines, the verb to kill remained as foolproof in the 17th year as it had been in the first. And each year at Hanukkah, they learned the familiar story which they had already heard 100 times before, of how the Maccabees resisted the Greek influences which were so powerful and so popular, stood up for their Jewish traditions, and purified the temple. Anthony was not popular with his classmates, who saw him as a nerd and a teacher's pet. They never called him by his secular name, but always referred to him mockingly as Elhanan. All the same, Anthony enjoyed studying with Mr. Bialik, and for Mr. Bialik, Anthony was his prize pupil. He often repeated a phrase they had read in the Ethics of the Fathers, "Sit in the dust at your master's feet and drink in his words with relish." Anthony drank in Mr. Bialik's words with relish. Now, on the first night of Hanukkah, Mr. Bialik was an unprecedented 20 minutes late. He was not here to remind them how the apikorsim, the unbelievers, had turned to the ways of the Greeks and forgotten God, or to ask them to imagine how much courage it must have taken to stick up for one's principles and join the tiny band of Maccabees. Frankly, none of the children could imagine it. Chaos reigned, but the degree of noise in the third classroom had not yet penetrated to the office at the far end of the corridor. The blackboard was a sacrilegious rainbow. Suddenly, the door flew open. Sammy Goldstein burst in, wearing Mr. Bialik's spare glasses and the caretaker's overalls. Chaim! Gary. Chaim dropped his chalk. He leapt on Sammy's back and thumped him beneath the Hanukkah poster which read, "There was a great miracle here." Get off, Sammy yelled. You'll break his blooming glasses. The noise in the third classroom finally brought Mr. Schiffer crashing in from next door. He was horrified to find the children unsupervised. In his anger, he never noticed the cheerful profanities covering the blackboard. He went off to fetch Mrs. Minchum, the secretary. The class united and scrubbed the blackboard clean with scarves, sleeves, hands. By the time Mrs. Minchum reached the door, everyone was in their places with their arms folded, causing her to hesitate in the unexpected quiet. She glanced diffidently toward the empty teacher's desk. She consulted the clock and her watch and the smeared blackboard on which a few letters still hung in a cloud of chalk. "Hasn't he turned up, then?" David Greenblatt shrugged his shoulders and spread his arms as if to say, "We haven't done away with him." "Well, have you got something you can be getting on with?" Vigorous nodding. "Get on with it, then, but quietly. Anthony, I'm leaving you in charge." She strutted out, leaving the door ajar. Anthony clung to his place. A small gust seemed to rustle the pages of his Gateway to the Mishnah. "Listen, everyone. Elchanan's in charge. You've got to do as he says. Come on, Elchanan." Reluctantly, Anthony walked to the blackboard and turned to face the class. Standing before the blackboard, faced with the mob of his fellow students, Anthony took a small piece of chalk in his hand. He knew what he was supposed to do. He was supposed to write the names of the worst offenders on the blackboard for Mr. Bialik to see when he arrived, if Mr. Bialik ever did arrive. It was too dishonorable. More to the point, it would have no effect. These children were not afraid of losing Mr. Bialik's good opinion, which they never had in the first place. He would only be proving himself a sneak, a tale-teller, a teacher's pet. "Come on, Elhanan, tell us what to do." The class was already heaving like a restless sea. Another minute, and they would be beyond his reach. Anthony drew a deep breath. Wasn't this a perfect opportunity to make himself popular? Couldn't he do something to win prestige for himself? Temptation lay before him in the waiting faces of his classmates. Smoothly, deliberately, he drew a series of dashes across the board. "Hangman!" one of the girls called. Anthony turned to face them with a crooked smile. "Sort of," he said. Now, as he stood before the blackboard, he was making a bid, quite hopeless, in fact, to be admitted to the ranks of his contemporaries. Not Mr. Bialik's boy anymore, no longer a nerd and a bookworm, a modern boy, rude and raucous, streetwise, one of them. It was the sort of hangman where you couldn't lose. Guess the right letters and get Elhanan to write a juicy obscenity. Guess the wrong ones and get him to fill in the next voluptuous detail on his drawing of Judy. An exciting game, his own invention, and the class was spellbound. The boys sniggered, and the girls pretended to be shocked. Samantha Miller, whose Hebrew name was Shoshana, was the only one who seemed genuinely distressed. Anthony liked her, and a pang of misgiving shot across his heart. Daniel Rifkind proposed a Z, and Anthony filled in Judy's left nipple. There were groans and catcalls, a hissing from David Greenblatt, who added lewdly, "Elhanan, I'd never have thought it of you." And Anthony felt a hot rush of danger and shame. Even as he sketched in the details of his own betrayal, he knew that he would never be accepted and that he would always be Elhanan. They were laughing at him, not with him. Afterwards, David and Daniel and Gary would tear off across the playground in a ragged threesome, snorting a while over Elhanan's dirty mind and then turning their attention to something else. He filled in Judy's fine points with extra vigor, and gales of laughter blew across the class. Even the boys, he suspected, were embarrassed now. He had gone too far. He had betrayed himself. "What an idiot I've been," he thought, scribbling hard. "Why should I be like them? I should have stuck to my principles." The chalk broke. He scrubbed harder. "I should be like a Maccabee." But behind him, the class had gone quiet, and with good reason. For there, in the open doorway, Mr. Bialik stood, his overcoat whitened by snow. His journey had been a struggle. He was nearly half an hour late, but he had made it at last. He couldn't deny his class their Hanukkah party. In his hand was a bag of donuts, but behind the spectacles, his eyes were edged with tears. "What is this?" he cried out, regarding the blackboard, his voice cracked by incredulity and dismay. "Is this by you, Anthony? Is it Elhanan?" And Anthony ran, coatless, from the third class, across the hall floor with its blue Star of David, outside, into the purifying snow.
Thank you.
I'm Murray Horwitz.
And I'm Susan Stamberg with NPR's Hanukkah Lights.
In a few minutes, on a tiny Pacific island, desperate men find new hope in a quiet celebration of light.
Right now, a troubled young woman is faced with a sudden and tragic loss, yet also finds her way to a new, rewarding life. This is First Day by Elisa Albert. I spent 16 weeks at the center, and today's my first day out. This morning, I went for groceries. Almonds, grown 3 hours north, go in the door of the fridge. Oranges, grown an hour south, go into a wooden bowl I found in a cabinet. Tea, picked and dried only on certain days of the lunar calendar, lined up on the counter. Kava, fennel, rooibos, dried sage standing at the ready in a coffee-stained mug. One at a time, I gather what I need. I'm taking it slow. I am a sure-footed panther. In my new life, I own a suitcase of clothes, 7 books, a journal, computer, phone, 2 pairs of shoes, Japanese prayer mug. I got rid of the rest, gave it away, let it go, haven't missed it for a minute. I come from a long line of people with way too much stuff, each more loaded and miserable than the next, but they're not my problem. "Look forward," reads the affirmation card I put on the fridge. The mug is maybe superfluous, but it's an extraordinary mug. I use it every day, and Arya says we can't let go of things until we're truly ready. My new place is quiet, a semi-furnished apartment on a short-term lease. I'm back in the world, reborn into calm, into quiet. Quiet inside, quiet outside. At the center, I healed, was reborn. A few weeks ago, we did a meditation in which we each spent a full minute slowly, silently chewing a raisin. Have you ever really experienced a raisin? Close your eyes so your other senses sharpen. Resist the urge to swallow.
What if all your food could taste like this?
Arya said.
What if your whole life could be like this? This conscious, this endless, this flavorful.
It was the first raisin of my life. Later, in bed, my roommate Lottie wept. What was that even about? I mean, seriously. Lottie's troubles greatly eclipsed even my own. Her parents had found her wandering Eastern Europe, half dead. She'd been sleeping on the street, prostituting, didn't remember a lot of the details. My problems weren't half so dramatic. A more abstract exile, twice weekly therapy, cluttered antidepressant, anti-anxiety cocktail with wine and pot garnish. Almost never left my house. Online shopping all the time. Everything a threat. Zombie town. Population 1. My hair had started to fall out. I had no one. Arya always retells his own story. The cocaine habit that destroyed the inside of his nose. The nasty custody battle that estranged him from his children. The time he spent in prison for stealing money from his congregation. In recovery, he found redemption and a calling, and the center was born, a cross between a synagogue, a prison, a spa, and a mental hospital. My stay was voluntary, not so Lottie's. Groups in a couple of hours, and the center's a 20-minute walk, so I have time to make my slow, sure-footed way. Maybe stop at the cafe. I lock my strange new door, and the world opens before me. I turn onto busy Santa Monica Boulevard. West Hollywood really goes nuts with the seasonal decorations. Happy holidays, ho, ho, ho. one foot in front of the other, cut through the good air. The sky is comically blue, the day bright and clear. 85 in December, imagine that. It happens that my new life, my first day, coincides with the beginning of Hanukkah. When I grew up, I had no idea what Hanukkah was even about, that there could be meaning behind it. I thought it was a way for Jews to be passive-aggressive about Christmas. My mother would host 8 distinct, impeccably catered parties. Aria says this is no coincidence, my new life, the Festival of Lights.
We're each of us a light,
he said yesterday at my farewell ceremony.
The light animates us. We are its guardian. The true miracle is our willingness to take a risk, to leap into the unknown, to set afire what's not serving us, to let our attachments be consumed, and to celebrate the light that's left. A festival of lights, and each of us a light. Rachel, a light.
There wasn't a dry eye in the house. We sat in a big circle in the evening light. We each lit individual candles from one central candle surrounded by rose petals. We sat staring at our flames, watching their slow burn. We called out what we saw: warmth, steadiness, confidence, light, life, destruction. And Aria said a special blessing to send me on my way.
May you be the fierce guardian of your light, Rachel. May you seek and manifest miracles of your choosing.
Then, before my candle burned all the way down, I lit the first candle in the menorah. Everyone cheered. I find a seat by the window at the cafe, order a tea, and overhear talk about the weather, the unseasonable heat. It seems everyone yearns to speak of other things. I fear my son's spectrum disorder is my fault. Taking care of my elderly parent has devastated me. I don't love my wife. I can't get pregnant. I am $75,000 in debt. I am worried about the implications of climate change. But only buried deep beneath, how about this crazy weather? And now I see a guy I used to know standing out in front of the cafe. My gut sputters like a dead engine. Our parents are friends. Once we had a thing. He is smoking one of those dumb fake cigarettes that is not a cigarette designed to help you quit. 15 years later, he's gone fat, which is, of course, intensely satisfying. He feels me watching him, recognizes me, comes in.
Oh, my God, wow, Rachel, wow.
He's the kind of excitable guy who seems always to be leering. He's hauling enormous shopping bags, the fake cigarette glowing now in the pocket of his hideously patterned Western shirt. A semi-famous actor who lived at the center for a few weeks had a whole wardrobe of those Western shirts with snap buttons, a heroin habit, too. I point to the fake cigarette. Don't you have to put that out?
Wow, Rachel, what do you know? What are you up to?
Our thing was an awful time, a blur of a time. I was some other girl then, that awful other girl. I put my book, Thich Nhat Hanh on Anger, spine up on the table like an advertisement for how different I am now. I smile a polite smile. The polite smile comes in handy. It works the way suddenly turning out the lights in a room will reliably quiet people. Just sitting.
Wow, it's been a long time.
You're married, I heard. He holds up his left hand.
8 years.
Kids?
Twins.
He shows me a picture on his phone. Cute. They're weird looking, hollow-eyed, with polite smiles of their own, as though the lab in which they were harvested and grown forgot to program them with joy.
Presents,
he says, gesturing to the shopping bags.
They have it pretty good.
I bet. I assume our mothers still cater parties for each other, but I've lived way across town since forever ago. Never go west of Fairfax. I might as well live on the moon. He leaves the shopping bags by my feet, goes to order a coffee. When I knew him, he carried a flask in his jacket pocket, spiked everything. He had dreadlocks. One time we got arrested for public indecency on the beach. He comes back with his coffee and just stands there until I say he's welcome to have a seat.
So, what about you? Boyfriend?
I shake my head, unclench my jaw. Last year, there was a lovely man at the bookstore wearing a newsboy cap, medium height, balding, glasses, reading Krishnamurti. Intelligent and kind, a sweetness so palpable, I didn't know whether to straddle him or offer him cradled arms and a breast, or both. This is someone I could love, flashed a neon sign in the dark of my mind. This is someone I could love. But no one was maintaining the sign, see, so some of the bulbs slowly buzzed and blinked out, and within a couple of months the sign was illegible. And so I told the lovely man I did not love him, told him to go away, told him his glasses were stupid, told him that he slobbered on my neck when he kissed me, that he was gross, started sleeping with someone we both knew, drank 3 tumblers of scotch one night and screamed, "Get out!" Told him he was dumb and a jerk, that his newsboy cap was hideous. Nope, I say, no boyfriend.
How are your folks?
No idea.
You don't talk to them?
Nope. An Amy Winehouse song comes on. The cute girls behind the counter do a half-unconscious tandem dance to the opening bars. Before Amy Winehouse died, Rehab would come on in a bar or something, and people would smirk, nod, clink glasses. They tried to make me go to Rehab. Now the room kind of collapses, everyone wearing the same baleful frown. And I said, no, no, no. Oh, Amy, I say. I wished I had the temerity to have her face tattooed on my bicep. Sweet little heartsick dumpling.
Patron saint of lost Jewish girls.
It's not funny.
Amy, come back. Amy, I can save you. Amy, be my girl.
I was 23 when we were together. He was like a drug. Days would go by and we'd still be naked and high. Now he's sweaty, overfed, with lousy posture. People turn into themselves. There's no avoiding it. People become physical manifestations of exactly what they are. Nice to see you, I say, getting my stuff together, standing up.
Hey!
He says, trying to hug me.
Take my card. We should hang sometime.
Why I take the card, I have no idea. I toss it into the first garbage can I pass. And when I get to group, Lottie's not there. What the hell? Where is she? Going back to the same old miserable life? So they're going to have to scrape her off the street again? Another sad, doomed little heartsick dumpling? Damn her. Then, just before we start, Aria's assistant beckons me into her office. She closes the door. She takes a deep breath. Lottie's dead.
What?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
How?
She shakes her head, squeezes shut her eyes. It had to be pills. Lottie loved her some pills. Jumped. Downtown. Got a ride to go shopping, went to someone's loft, someone she knew, I don't know, disappeared up a stairwell. They found her on the street. I know you guys were friends. I'm sorry. Jumped. That is entirely not messing around. I am strangely proud of her. And then I think I might throw up. And then it's like flash bulbs have gone off in my face. Too much light. The word jump, so soaring, hopeful, a blinding flash. And then street, unforgiving. Bam, total darkness, disorientation. She was named for a great-great aunt who had done something heroic before dying at Sobibor. She had long, elegant fingers and a mole on the knuckle of her right pinky. Lank, swinging, dirty blonde hair, beautiful, hard shoulders ringed with tattoos. Those awesome terracotta-colored corduroy bell-bottoms.
Friends,
Aria says after the invocation,
we've had a tragic loss. Our community has had a terrible, tragic loss. A light has gone out.
He doesn't say jumped. He doesn't say streaked. I had been planning to speak about my first day, my new life, the miracles soon to manifest. I'd been rehearsing a reflection on running into that guy I used to know, about how it was a gift running into him because I'm so different now, see? Because I am no longer that awful other girl, because I am a light, a bright, unwavering flame. But I say nothing. Aria lights the menorah himself tonight, 2 candles, no blessing. Then he leads a Kaddish for Lottie, even though I'm pretty sure you're only supposed to say Kaddish for a member of your immediate family. When group is over, people hold their arms open to me, crying. Angel flying too close to the sun, says Dan, who was in the first Gulf War and has been coming here longest of anyone. The polite smile is involuntary now. My face feels Botoxed. The corners of my vision have gone wobbly. There will have to be quiet and more quiet and quiet after that. I will have to go somewhere else. Further away, maybe even further than that. A few weeks ago, I lost consciousness in a session with a healer and awoke in an altered state. I was different. I felt calm, luminous. That was good, the healer said, turning his love-filled face toward me. You really moved down into your core and let go a lot. When I got back to our room, I told Lottie about the letting go, about moving into my core, my great energetic success, my vast calm. Good for you, she said, and began, as usual, to cry. I just completely let go, I said. It was amazing. I let go of everything, Lottie. You have to go see this guy. He's a miracle. Look, she said into her pillow, that's great. Congratulations. I'm really happy for you, but I'm not getting better. Her voice was muffled. You are, but I'm not. I can't. No, I lied, trying so hard to ape the radiant light I saw in the face of the healer. You can. You are. Fidelis by Erica Dreyfuss. Jack Marcus, about to turn 18, had not set foot in synagogue since his bar mitzvah nearly 5 years back. But on this Sabbath, the first after what President Roosevelt had called the unprovoked and dastardly attack on Pearl Harbor, an attack that Mayor LaGuardia had warned might be repeated elsewhere, even right there in New York, Jack didn't argue. He didn't say anything. He simply opened the closet door and handed his surprised parents their coats before he slid into his own. They were quiet, all three of them, as they left the apartment and walked, shivering, down the sleet-slickened blocks. It was December 13th. The next night, as the rabbi reminded the Marcuses and all the other families packed into the pews, would mark the beginning of the festival of Hanukkah. Jack didn't remember much from those afternoons he'd been forced to spend in Hebrew school, but he remembered Hanukkah because that nonsense about the oil lasting for 8 days and the ritual of lighting the menorah and the silly dreidel games aside, Hanukkah was different. It was different because it wasn't another dismal story of punishment or slavery or loss. No, Hanukkah was, instead, a story of triumph, a story about Jewish fighters, Jewish strength. And if there was one thing that Jack could appreciate from the time he had fended off some of the Irish kids in the neighborhood, it had happened only once because Jack managed to split the lip of one of the bigger kids. It was a tale in which the Jews won, in which they were strong. Strength and victory mattered now, too. This is the most important opportunity that Judaism has had as a spiritual force since the days of the Maccabees, the rabbi intoned. Never before have we Jews found ourselves so staunchly and so completely allied with our fellow citizens of other faiths as we do in this war brought on us by Japan. Around Jack, heads nodded. Never before. Well, Jack couldn't be sure about that. History was not his best subject. In fact, you could say that school itself wasn't his best subject. But Jack wasn't stupid. He paid attention. He knew enough to suspect that the anger against the Japs, a fury that you could hear on the radio and practically see in the streets of the city, was fueling an American war cry infinitely more powerful than the head shaking about what the Nazis were doing to Jews in Europe. And Jack could understand it. After all, even he, a Jew, hadn't focused all that much on what was happening across the Atlantic until he saw the letters from Europe, letters from distant cousins he had never heard of, letters whose crackling paper sheets begged his parents to help this one's daughter or that one's son immigrate to the United States. His parents had tried, but so far, nothing. The rabbi continued, "Every American Jew now has the chance, for which he has longed, to fight face to face and on equal terms in the defense of those who have been his friends in times of trial and for the preservation of those ideals by which his friends and he can hope to live in peace." Here, Jack nodded, too. As soon as he turned 18, just a few weeks from now, he was heading to the recruiting center downtown. A bunch of his friends had already enlisted. He couldn't wait to do the same. His parents knew this. His girl, Alice, knew this. Sure, they were worried, but they knew what he had to do. Besides, it wasn't as though he had other plans. And if his parents thought that they were keeping their disappointments hidden, talking in low voices in the next room about his terrible grades, his lack of focus, his hazy professional future, they thought wrong. The rabbi was still speaking. "May we prove ourselves equal to the unprecedented emergency and worthy of the priceless privileges we enjoy by manifesting the Maccabee spirit of faith, fortitude, and devotion to the cause of liberty and justice." Murmured amens seemed to rise from the pews. Jack's mother dabbed at her eyes. Then she squeezed Jack's hand. On Jack's other side, his father coughed. 2 years later, Jack was a Marine. He hadn't been sent to Europe, which he knew was a relief both to his parents and to Alice. "What if the Nazis capture you and find out that you're Jewish?" she had whispered when he first told her that he was going to join up. Frankly, Jack had kind of hoped to have the chance to kill some Nazi bastards himself, but he hadn't said that to Alice. In any case, he was sent to the Pacific instead, and these 2 years had taken him places he had never imagined he might see: California, Hawaii, New Zealand. But he had never imagined Tarawa either. Tarawa, a chain of coral-reefed islands, tiny specks in the Central Pacific. One of its islands possessed an airstrip, The Americans simply had to win control from the Japanese, smoothing the way further west. This was their mission. But the tides had tricked them, as had their maps. And they never expected the Japanese to fight back so hard. Yes, the Americans had won, but it had cost them dearly. It had cost Jack his two best buddies. It had forced him to leave them in the reddening water while he pushed on to the beachhead. Most of the ones who had made it through, wounded and non-wounded alike, had been moved to Hawaii. But some of them, like Jack, were still on guard, still perched in the Pacific in a spot none of them could have identified on a map before. He would never admit it aloud, and he sure didn't breathe a word in his letters to his parents and Alice. But since Tarawa, Jack just didn't feel right. Weeks had passed since he had stood at attention, watching the colors run up that palm tree in victory. But his skin still smelled of smoke. Machine gun fire still thrummed in his ears. And it seemed that whenever he closed his eyes, he saw them. The dead, including his buddies, floating face down as the shallow waves lapped the shore. Thanksgiving had come right after the battle, the strangest Thanksgiving Jack could remember. And now his commanding officer was telling him a chaplain was coming to celebrate a Jewish holiday. Jack should attend the service. Before Tarawa, Jack might have resisted the suggestion, inwardly at least, even if he would have ultimately obeyed it. Apart from the H on his dog tags that marked him as a member of the Hebraic faith, thus guaranteeing that a Star of David would appear over any grave in which he might be laid to rest, an identifying choice that Jack had made to comfort his parents and Alice, he had done nothing to declare himself a Jew. Why bother? He wasn't about to reject ham and the mess or even ask for time to pray on the high holy days. And yet, more than once, he had thought back to the rabbi's words about a staunch and complete alliance with his fellow citizens of other faiths. Because even here in the Marines, where they were all quite obviously on the same side, not everyone of other faiths shared those sentiments. Mostly, it had been a matter of dumb questions, even in one case, an inquiry about Jack's horns. Only once had the situation turned really ugly, and just as he had done back home, Jack split the offender's lip. But all of that was then, before Tarawa. This was now, the first night of Hanukkah. Jack walked with a briskness that surprised him to a tent with its sides rolled up. The wind whistled. There were no seats, only a makeshift pulpit covered with a blanket on which the menorah stood. 8 orange candles sat beneath an elevated 9th. The sun was sinking. "Welcome to our chapel," said the chaplain, who introduced himself as Rabbi Rudin of Great Neck. Jack held the rabbi's handshake a few moments longer than usual. "I'm from New York, too," he said. In New York, Jack had realized just a few weeks into training, at least 3/4 of the people he encountered any given day were Jews. Not so life in the Marines. This, too, had not mattered so much before. Jack stood in a small semicircle along with the others, only one of whom he had realized was also Jewish. Chaplain Rudin lit the elevated candle, the shamas, he called it. Then, with that candle, he lit only one more, one at the end of the row. "Baruch atah Adonai," the chaplain began. Almost all the others joined in, but Jack couldn't remember the blessing's words. The chaplain explained that since this was the festival's first night, they would recite not only the 2 special blessings for the holiday, but also the Shehechianu. This Jack remembered, sort of. He remembered it well enough to anticipate the English translation and to choke slightly as the chaplain pronounced the words, "Blessed are you, Lord our God, for giving us life, for sustaining us, and for enabling us to reach this season." Yes, Jack had reached this season, but at Tarawa, so many others had not. As the sun sank still lower, the chaplain distributed small boxes. From the Jewish Welfare Board, he explained. The folks at home were thinking about them, he said, and Jack and the others shouldn't forget that. Jack hated the lump in his throat. He focused on the little box and its contents, which included a small wooden dreidel. He turned the item over, looked at the Hebrew letters on each side, and wished that he had listened back in the synagogue classroom when he was told what the letters represented. "Nez gadol hayasham," the chaplain said, as if reading Jack's mind. "It means a great miracle happened there." A few minutes remained before they would need to end the service. The chaplain suggested a holiday song. Most of the men joined in. A milestone, Jack thought, likely the first time in the history of the world that Rock of Ages was ringing from this particular point in the Pacific. It was nearly dark as the song ended. The wind blew again through the tent. Jack gazed at the flickering flames of the shamas and the other candle. And then, while Jack and the chaplain and the others looked on, the wind's whistle deepened to a growl. The tent strained. Beneath the menorah, the blanket's edges shook. The wind might have extinguished the two candles, the shamas and the candle that represented the festival's first night. Jack half expected it to do exactly that, but that didn't happen. Instead, the shamas seemed to shine even brighter. Yes, the flame atop the other candle yielded, but it did not die. It bent and leaned, reaching toward the unlit candle next to it until that one, too, was alight. Almost instantly, the new flame also curved with the wind, nearly flattening before it ignited the candle on its other side. So the pattern continued all the way down the menorah until all nine lights gleamed gold against the darkness. The wind quieted. For a moment, there was silence. Then a murmur seemed to rise from the semicircle. Jack held his breath and watched the candles blaze. He didn't dare look at anyone. He blinked fast. He squeezed the dreidel in his fist. He coughed. And then he said, "Amen."
Hanukkah Lights, readings for the holiday season with Susan Stamberg and Murray Horwitz. All the stories you've just heard were commissioned by NPR and written especially for Hanukkah Lights. Gloria Davidis Kirchheimer, who wrote Nona Maccabeus, also wrote the popular story collection Goodbye, Evil Eye, and the novel Amelie in Orbit. Ethics of the Fathers was written by Tamar Yellen. Her stories have appeared in a variety of publications and in her collection Kafka in Bronte Land and other stories. Elisa Albert, the author of First Day, also wrote the novel The Book of Dahlia. Her short stories have appeared in a number of anthologies and in her own collection, How This Night is Different. Erica Dreyfuss, who wrote Fidelis, is the author of Quiet Americans, a short story collection inspired by the experiences of her paternal grandparents, German Jews who immigrated to the United States in the late 1930s. She lives in New York City. Stories from past editions of Hanukkah Lights have been collected in an illustrated book called Hanukkah Lights, Stories of the Season. The book is available at the NPR shop, online at shop.npr.org or at 1-888-NPR-DISC. To hear this year's stories again, Along with stories from previous Hanukkah Lights programs, you can visit npr.org/holidays. Hanukkah Lights was produced and edited by Bruce Scott with recording engineer Neil Tivault. Music was by Jorah Feidman from his recordings on the BMG and ROM labels. Thanks for joining us for the 2011 edition of Hanukkah Lights from NPR.
Happy Hanukkah, everybody.